Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM and soon-to-be DAB radio programme about transport and design. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We're chatting art, transport, communications history, that's C-A-T-C-H, it's the Catchcast. And in this edition, do you remember a train journey where you noticed one of those beautiful bucolic British landscapes nestling under a luggage rack? A feature of past pleasantries, perhaps, but today's guest has made it his task to seek out hundreds of those beautiful artworks and now has the largest collection of them in the country. Welcome to the Catchcast, Greg Norden.
Good evening, Mark. Yes.
Lovely to have you here, Greg, and we are going to discuss your incredible collection in a bit. But I wonder if we can kick off by talking a bit about where your interest in railways and transport began. I think you had a sort of a childhood connection to the London Southampton Railway. Didn't you?
Yes, lived at New Malden on the main line. I think it was through some school friends who introduced me to the whole idea of sort of railway enthusiasm. And we lived down Elm Road, which was a road which had a level crossing at the top. So we used to go up there. This was in the end days of steam, so we caught the end of that. The level crossing actually was, used to go up there, watch the trains, and I ended up one day climbing across some breeze blocks there, and I managed to impale myself on an iron railing there, which was, wasn't a lot of fun, but I managed to survive that.
And so, oh my goodness.
My well, enthusiasm continued from that, yes.
That didn't dampen your spirits for the trains then. That must have been quite painful, my goodness. How old were you at the time?
I must have been about 14. I think.
But having a level crossing at the end of the road, I'm always fascinated by level crossings. When you stand there and you see the train thundering by, you really feel it even more powerfully than if you're standing on a platform, don't you?
Yeah, it's a very interesting location there. It's on the Kingston Loop, so you had the main line and then the branch line coming off as well. So yeah, so quite a few people in the school were interested at the time, and you don't tend to get that nowadays, but
too many mobile phones to look at.
Exactly.
So that life you had near to the railway line had absolutely no influence whatsoever on what you did when you left school then?
Well, it did really, because I was, interested. It was, well, interesting to know how I first got involved with working for BR, because I was in Cricklewood Depot. I shouldn't have been in there at the time, and I was about 16, I think I was, in Cricklewood Depot, and I slid on the rails and then dislocated my fingers.
Oh, my goodness. Probably
guessed I'm a bit accident-prone. So I went to seek out the depot manager, who kindly took me to hospital to get them reset, and while he was there, he said, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to get the police to come and see you." So this policeman came on a Wednesday evening to my parents' house, and I was dreading it, but in the end, he spent the whole evening with us. We got on like a house on fire. He said, "You've got a fantastic railway knowledge. Why don't you join the railway?" So he gave me an application form. So I left my A-levels and started working at Waterloo. It was about 1971.
Crikey.
In the public correspondence section, yeah.
Wow. So a little accidental slip-up led to your career in the railways.
Yeah, I worked at Waterloo originally, Wimbledon, and later on in Paddington HQ, mainly on train planning, freight train planning. But I used to get very bored, so I used to end up drawing line diagrams for people, because we had no sort of maps, line diagrams to use in the offices. So I ended up drawing those in the end before I left, yeah.
Oh, a man after my own heart. I used to love drawing maps. So your job at BR then, was it mainly in the offices, or did you get to move around the country at all?
No, we did some work around the country, mainly when TOPS, the Total Operations Processing System, came into being. We used to do data integrity checks around the system, Southampton, Woking, places like that. So we did that, but it was called TOPS, but we tended to call it BOTTOMS, which was I thought was rather clever at the time.
And I think this opportunity gave you the chance to get round most of Britain and see the railway network, didn't it?
Yes, tried to travel over most of the passenger and freight lines around the country. By the time I was about 18, we'd travelled over a good proportion of the railways.
Oh, what a great thing to be able to do. A real ambition of mine to sort of travel every single line. And how long did you stay with BR? And when you left, what did you do next, Greg?
About 15 years I was with them. And in the end, we'd moved up to Northamptonshire. I was involved in some church work there. So I tried to get a transfer, which wasn't really on. So I had to, sadly, sort of leave the railways and then got a job as an area sales manager in Builders Merchants. So complete change.
Wow, that is a big change. So you'd left the world of transport for a while, but I gather you suffered quite a severe bout of illness for a while.
Yes, we were very successful as a company, but it was very incredibly demanding, stressful. So, and I got the flu virus, I think it was 1990, I think it was. Tried to go back into work for about 6 months, and I got worse and worse and worse. And in the end, my immune system packed up, digestive system packed up. And so for about 5 years, I couldn't walk more than about 100 yards. So,
oh, my goodness.
Took about 10 years before it really started to sort of to improve a lot. That was quite a difficult time.
Oh, my goodness, Greg. I'm sorry to hear that. Now, Greg, during your recovery from your illness, I think you made a bit of a discovery under your bed.
Well, I knew that there was a pile of these pictures, carriage prints, under my bed. They've been there for years and years and years. And when I worked for the railways, I got a phone call one day in the 1970s from an old chap that George, his name was, who worked at Waterloo Stores. And he said, "We've binning loads of stuff in the stores." He said, "If you want to come up and have a look, do." So I shot up there because it's where I used to work, underneath the arches there. And I was too timid to ask him for the bigger posters, any of the bigger posters. They're all going into Skip. And so he showed me the carriage pictures there. So I just took a pile of them. He said, "Take those because we're only going to chuck them." So, yeah, I took those and they stayed under my bed for years and years and years. So I finally had the time, being ill, to actually look at them and do a bit of research. So I contacted the National Railway Museum, who didn't really know too much about them, and tracked down people who had more, and managed to piece together a lot of what was produced, very detective work over the years, to find out which original paintings were still going, everything like that.
So, right. Can you remind us what train carriages used to be like and why the operators started placing artworks under those luggage racks in the first place?
I think originally, late 1800s, the interior decor of the carriages was just a plain bulkhead wall. So I think the original intention was to just enhance the decor by putting pictures, photographs mainly, and mirrors in the carriages, just to improve the decor. And I think later on they thought, well, we could impart information through notices and encourage travel as well, so more of the photograph images of places to travel to. And then obviously later on they thought they could sell some of their services, so that was later on. But initially it was just to enhance the decor of the carriages.
And in your book you've got some beautiful photographs of some of those early carriages and compartments. They looked really quite grandiose and quite luxurious, even the third class, didn't they?
Yeah, very, very ornate, beautiful carpentry and swept head frames, and everything must have cost them a lot to produce, but beautiful works of art, really.
Makes a bit of a contrast between those kind of ironing board seats we have to sit on today, doesn't it?
Yes.
So what are some of the earliest carriage prints, artworks, that you have in your collection, please, Greg?
They first started putting pictures in, photographs, in 1884 on the Great Eastern Railway, and they were very basic photographs with handwritten titles on them. And then I've just got one of those. And then the Great Western Railway, actually the Great Western Railway had original paintings in some of their carriages.
Goodness.
I don't think many. Yeah, it's unbelievable now, isn't it? and then they started to put the colour tinted prints in, which we'll probably get onto afterwards. Yeah,
and yeah, we'll definitely talk about the colour tinting process in a second, if you like. And as they were becoming more popular, it must have been quite a task to equip so many railway carriages, because there were thousands of them, weren't they, with all these prints. Can you give us any idea about the size of the operation? I don't know, around about, say, the turn of the century?
Yeah, it was the Photochrome Company based in Tunbridge Wells. Now, they were the main company, and the Great Western Railway started to put those in 1895, and they were beautiful colour-tinted photographs. Quite amazing, really, because the ones I've got a big collection of them, and they've hardly faded at all since then, since 1895, 1897 time. Other main railway companies at the time started to put them in as well, the Great Northern Railway, the London South Western. Most of the main companies used Photochrome. So they had about 2,000 odd views of the country then, and they're all colour tinted, and they also make postcards, so it was a big production line that Photochrome had. And yeah, so that sort of revolutionised things, really.
And this process then of colourising a picture, I mean, modern graphic designers might be used to this concept by using AI to colourise old monoprints, but they didn't have anything like as exclusive as that. How did they actually change a black and white photograph to give it some colour?
There was some technique. It was meant to be secret, but it must have involved, obviously, artists to actually tint the photographs. But there's some chemical process as well, which is beyond me anyway.
They sprayed some kind of chemical on there and then maybe cooked it or dipped it in acid or something. Yeah. And it wasn't just artworks that passengers could look at, was it? There were also advertisements and the start of using in-car maps.
Yeah, I think it took a time for the railways to realise that they had a captive audience for advertising purposes. They're quite slow on the uptake, I think. And after a while, they began to realise that they could advertise their shipping, their transport, hotels, as well as commercial ads. So you had firms like Hovis and Weetabix and that taking out large advertising campaigns to put in the panels in the railway carriages, yeah.
When would you say that the peak time of seeing these probably was then?
In terms of the photographs and adverts, that was up until the Second World War, really. That was the peak time between about the sort of 1900 and the Second World War. And then afterwards, it became obviously much more artist-commissioned paintings that they produced from then onwards, as well as the adverts and maps obviously continued.
Yeah, I know. Does this form the bulk of your collection then, that sort of prime period leading up to the Second World War?
Well, I've tried to get an example of almost everything, really. So obviously the pre-grouping, sort of pre-1923 era, is much more difficult to find because obviously a lot of that was damaged, etc. And also before the Second World War, a lot of the scenic views, either the prints or the photographs out of the carriages, so they could put wartime notices in. So a lot of the pre-war, Second World War items are difficult to find as well.
Oh, it's a shame. I mean, there really must be a load of wonderful examples that, as you say earlier on, got put in a skip or have never seen the light of day or weren't collected. You've told us how most of the early displays were made from photographs, but progressively artists were commissioned specifically to draw or paint the contents of these panels.
Yes, I think before the war, the artists or the printing techniques particularly were pretty basic, and so they had to rely on, initially, it was etchings that they put in the carriages, which were very expensive to produce, and they did sell them as well to the public. And then as lithographic techniques advanced, then the prints started to appear. So they commissioned lots of the leading watercolour artists of the day, Royal Institute of Painters in Watercolours, Royal Watercolour Society, artists, top artists, to commission them to produce artworks, and they made prints of these. They turned out they were, I think, about a quarter of the price it cost to put photographs panels in. So, yeah, that was just after the war. Then things really started to move on.
Crikey, so even to our eyes, something like a photograph would clearly be inferior to a piece of artwork. The artworks were actually a bit cheaper than to make.
They were to produce, yes, yeah.
Now, you've amassed thousands of these wonderful artefacts. Well done to you for looking after them. What do you find is sort of the most popular when you talk to friends or people on your website? What do you think is the most popular ones?
Obviously, people have favourite artists, well-known artists like Roland Hilder, Leonard Squirrel, Frank Mason, Claude Buckle, Jack Marriott, people like that, McIntosh Patrick up in Scotland. But a lot of people tend to collect the carriage prints in the area that they associate or they've got nostalgic memories of. So it varies a lot. Some people like the artists, some people it's a geographical thing. But the heyday really was, in terms of the artists commissioned prints, was from just after the war, 1947, and then they produced hundreds then of landscape views all around Britain, of seaside resorts, mountain scenes, and towns, cities, even industrial locations as well on the LNER. So that was the real heyday of the artist's commission pictures, yeah.
Well, it stands to reason that people are interested in the areas that they know, I guess. But I just wonder, when did the maps themselves start to appear in the carriages? And how tricky was it for the companies to fit their sometimes huge networks into those tiny, long, thin spaces?
Well, the first map was the 1900 Great Eastern Railway. They were the first company to produce a map. They did one of the suburban line and one of the main line. And because, as you say, the trouble was it was such a long length to fit the map into compared to like a portrait view. These were long landscapes. So they had to show them more in sort of linear fashion and smooth the lines out to get all of the map in. So it must have been a real problem. And a lot of them were just shown as spidery lines, Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway. How people could see where they were or where they were going on these, goodness only knows. But and then obviously later on, George Dow produced his diagrammatic diagrams in 1929. And then that developed obviously for Harry Beck doing the London Transport ones. And then onto the later diagrams now, which we can read more easily.
I think one of the most infamous of those carriage print maps actually was by the Southern Railway, wasn't it?
Well, there's various Southern produced lots of different versions of, because they're always closing stations and things like that, so they had to produce a different map each year almost. Yeah, the Southern ones, and they showed down to the West Country. They were competing with the Great Western Railway, so their maps look completely different. So one of them exaggerated more of their lines and completely left out some of the Southern lines, and the Southern, they were a bit more generous. So there was lots involved in map design then. And then probably the best one is the Isle of Wight Railway, where that map's probably the most sought after, I think.
I've got one on my wall as we speak.
Yeah.
So coming back to the pictorial carriage prints, there was quite a heated debate, wasn't there, about the benefits of using photos or paintings?
Yeah, they had in 1937, they were viewing up, these sort of prints were starting to be produced. The photographic companies were very keen to maintain, obviously, their sales. So there was a bit of a debate going on. But I should imagine it would be similar to when the film cameras and then digital cameras came in. You know, there's a bit of a, at one time, saying, oh, digital cameras will never be as good as film cameras, the quality. But of course, in the end, and I think it was the same with the photographs, the days of the photographs, sepia and colour tinted ones, black and white photos, were limited really, and then they just faded out in the end.
Greg, you've told us about some of your favourite artists and the views you have in your collection, and you brought all this encyclopedic knowledge together a few years ago in an absolutely stunning book, one of the favourites in my collection, Landscapes Under the Luggage Rack. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about and some of the stories of pulling it all together?
It was the National Railway Museum who suggested doing a book on the subject because they didn't have a lot of knowledge of it. So I knew nothing about art at the time. I used to say to people I thought Hertz van Rentel was a Dutch painter. over the years, I obviously became more and more of an expert on watercolour art and that, but knew nothing about publishing, and we had one or two difficulties with publishers trying to rip us off at the time, so I thought we'd do it ourselves. So I did the design and the book and everything, and managed to raise the funds, which were quite a lot. So it took about 5 years to do, and of course I was then still recovering at the time from the ME, and but it was therapeutic, and yeah, in the end it went much better than I thought, because I think a lot of the travelling public remembered them in the carriages. They might not be interested in railways, but they certainly interested in art or nostalgia. And we did a Foyles book launch in the gallery, an exhibition there in London, and got nominated for the McColvin Medal, and got a bit of TV coverage, and then ended up selling over a couple of editions, 10,000 copies. So
wow.
For a highly illustrated book, it was much more successful than I thought.
Oh, you've done so well, and as I say, one of my favourite books. Now, you've worked with the TV documentary maker Nick Crane, haven't you? What was his connection to artists making these prints?
Well, Nick, smashing chap, really great, very helpful to us. His aunt was Frieda Marston, and she was one of the artists. In fact, she was the only lady artist commissioned to produce the landscape views of the railways, and she also did railway posters. And he's been collecting her artwork for years, so I'm always on the lookout for paintings as well as the artist's other artwork and that, because I've got to know a lot of the relatives over the years, and that's been really fascinating. But yeah, so yeah, we worked on doing a documentary. So we did an hour-long documentary together, Travelling Art Galleries. You see that on YouTube, free of charge, and that's in 10 parts. Nick Crane, very professionally, made me look as wooden as anything doing the production. Yeah,
no, I'm sure he didn't, but he is a nice chap, because he also interviewed me once in an old railway carriage at London Transport Museum. You have been incredibly prolific, Greg, running a blog and a website, making the documentary and that wonderful, wonderful book. I think we could probably go on chatting for ages, but I'm afraid we have to stop. Absolute pleasure to chat with someone who cares so deeply for art and railway history. Thank you so much for joining us today, Greg.
That's fine. Thank you, Mark. Yep.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to Greg as much as I have. You can find his carriage panels at travellingartgallery.com, and Greg's beautiful book, Landscapes Under the Luggage Rack, is actually out of print right now, I believe, but keep an eye out for it on one of your favourite secondhand bookshops. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications and history. Please do join us then.